You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 20th of October, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Once again, it's a Thursday, and that means we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from russjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm actually doing well. We're finally getting into a civilized part of the year, my favorite season. And, you know, I'm going to be away next week. I hope our listeners can survive a week without me.
I'm sure they can struggle to make their way through without you. And at least they know that you will be here the next week. And I am guessing that you will also pre-record a TON. So it won't be too difficult for them. They'll just have to miss out on the Daily Nationalist. But we are glad to have you here today. And today we're going to be talking about the EU and how it is making use of the Ukraine crisis in its propaganda. And we'll start by having a look at what the official explanation is for the European Union. The European Union, or the EU, is officially characterized by a purposeful diffusion of political authority between supranational and intergovernmental institutions, based on the idea of quasi-shared leadership. It formally relies on a delicate institutional balance, guarding declared equality between its ever more diverse members and managing potential and real tensions between the more and less populated and developed states. Such tensions are present in any federal construct and have been a key concern since the original six, the EU6, founded the West European Coal and Steel Community, or the ECSC, in 1951, and that was the Benelux countries, West Germany, France and Italy. The formal facts and official EU propaganda about itself is something that we all know, and we agree that it is an admirable and amazing concept, that all these different people, 27 member states today, from such colourful nations, decided to live together with the main purpose of having a big and united community, with trying to live in peace and comfort, and to enjoy the developed medical and educational systems. It is all we always read about in the press and see on TV. But there were no public releases about a single wrong or questionable decision or action that has been taken by the EU. So let's have a look at some different opinions on the EU. I do not want to write about a reality, because reality is such a subjective and questionable field, but I would like to draw the attention of a critical approach to the studies on the EU and European integration within the economic political umbrella of the European Union. All theoreticians of the European unification within the umbrella of post-World War II West European communities, today the EU, will stress four crucial points of its importance. Number one, it will bring to an end the millennial war-making between major European powers. Number two, a unified Europe will anchor the world power system in a polycentric structure with its economic and technological might and its cultural and political influence, probably together with the rise of the Pacific states. It will preclude the existence of any hegemonic superpower, despite the continuing military and technological preeminence of the USA. And number four, European unification is significant as a source of institutional innovation that may yield some answers to the crisis of the nation state. And we could say that, yes, there has been no war making between the nations that make up the EU, but what about the situation is for the actual members of these European states? What they're leaving out here is the loss of sovereignty that's gone on here. Matt, what do you make of what they're saying here about what the EU is supposed to stand for?
Well, in grad school, I took a advanced class in the European Union from Rafael Zariski, who's one of the used to be one of the world's leaders on the EU and especially Italian politics. And in his lectures, he stressed that the coal and steel community was a ruse, because if you unify all heavy industry under one umbrella, all other industries are going to have to follow. So the propaganda was, well, this is just coal and steel. This is when, in fact, the purpose was deceptive, not realizing that coal and steel, once that's brought into Europe, then forces everything else. So the whole thing was based on fraud, not to mention the fact that really its ultimate purpose, despite the propaganda, is that you have a monetary system controlled in Brussels, but the fiscal systems aren't. So EU bureaucrats make, you know, the major banks make monetary policy, and then they force member states to deal with it. So it's another example of privatizing profits and externalizing costs. So in the Greek crisis, for example, it wasn't so much that the EU loaded Greece up with debt, but then it was Greece's fault for not being able to deal with it, and then the entire country was stripped of its assets through the austerity programs. It seems that everything here is based on some form of deception, but ultimately it's an economic institution where industrial immigration, labor policy is made in one place, and the states that make it up then have to deal with the fallout. But of course it works the other way too, because a state like Greece can blame the European Union for something. Germany can blame the European Union. It's a great way for politicians to escape accountability. But it's almost designed, maybe not almost, it is designed to have the major issues, things like coal and steel and banking interest rates, concentrated in one place. But any cost that comes from that then has to be borne by the member states themselves. And then you add to that the immigration and the censorship. Now you have a tightly authoritarian system. And of course, no one actually voted for this stuff. They voted for propaganda. This stuff only became clear when it was around for a while. So, but I do think, and we've talked about this before, that this is the beginning of the end. We talked about Italexit. Germany has had enough of not just EU policy, but American policy. No one's really gaining from it. And, you know, Britain, you know, led the way years ago. And that's only just started. So many countries are rejected with the Lisbon Treaty, even Maastricht back in 92. There were riots in the Netherlands, if I'm not mistaken. So this stuff was simply forced on people without understanding the consequences. And I think really only now are the most blatant and negative consequences making themselves obvious.
I think there's also this increasing of the influence of these minority groups as well, at the expense of the influence and the power that the actual national groups have. For instance, if you think about Ukraine, straight away, as soon as Ukraine pulled itself away from Russia and it had its Maidan, straight away it was promoting gay pride, and exactly the same thing happened in Serbia, which goes against the views of these conservative Christian peoples. Yet the views and the rights of the LGBT community is held up as more important than the rights of the Serbians or the Ukrainians. And I do think this unwavering support for Ukraine, it goes against the grain with a lot of the people in the countries of the EU. We're seeing protests in France, massive protests in Germany. And they're just not being shown on the TV, but the general populations do not want to be freezing for Ukraine, which seems to be the catchphrase. Well, let's have a look at some more details on the EU here. As a matter of fact, European unification after World War II grew from the convergence of alternative visions, conflicting interests between nation states and between different economic and social actors. The very notion of Europe as based on a quasi-common identity is highly, however, questionable. Nevertheless, the European identity, historically, was racially constructed against the others, the barbarians of different kinds and different origins, Arabs, Muslims, Turks, and today, Russians. And the current process of unification is not different in this sense. Unification was made from a successive of defensive political projects around some perceived common interest. For instance, the Russian threat after the Cold War 1.0, and especially the 2014 Crimean crisis, followed by the Russian humanitarian intervention in East Ukraine in 2022, among participating nation states. The process of unification, therefore, was aimed at defending the participating countries against perceived threats in all of these cases. However, the final goal was primarily political, but the means to reach this goal were mainly economic measures. As another matter of fact, from the very start of the process of European unification after World War II, NATO provided the necessary military umbrella. So interesting there, saying that it's this need to defend themselves against Russia and against these external threats. That's what has pulled the EU together. But it's all really been because they just want to have a supranational control over all these European countries. And that's what he's pointing out here, is that they're trying to do the same thing with Ukraine. But as you pointed out, Matt, it seems to be working in the opposite direction, rather than these European countries pulling together because they're frightened of Russia. They're trying to get rid of their administrations because of all the increase in the prices of the gas and the electricity. What do you make of what's being said here?
Well, from the very beginning, the United States looked at the EU in two different ways. Number one, it was a way for Europe to recover from the war and with American financing. The other was that if it continues to centralize, it's going to be able to challenge the U.S. Now, I can't conceive of either of those things happening. De Gaulle was in favor of the EU primarily to control the Americans, one of the reasons he pulled out of NATO. But it's easy to get lazy when you have an American hegemon over everything. They haven't had to spend a whole lot on military or strategy. They've let the U.S. do everything. And talk about, you know, the so-called democratic peace, which has been around since Woodrow Wilson, if not before. The reason Europeans haven't gone to war, members of the EU, is because, you know, two world wars exhausted them. You had the alleged threat of the Soviet Union, although that didn't keep the EEC partners from trading with the USSR, and even before then. And having regular relationships with them, which they're not doing with Russia because of this government, and that, you know, they have the American hegemon controlling everything. So that has nothing to do with the European Union or the so-called democratic peace. And I think trying to use Russia as a way to unify it is a disaster. And it just creates this Russo-Chinese alliance that has now deepened into every area of economic life. But when you consider the censorship, the immigration, and the absolute failure of the Western European economies, especially when it comes to debt and the very fiscal things that the EU permits them to have, it's a failure on every level. And besides all that, you know, the question of identity, what he brings up here is, you know, what are so-called European values? You know, they're not values at all. Certain freedoms that they don't agree with, and war on Russia. They're completely negative. There's no positive identity. That could be said, you know, of the U.S. Today and the USSR yesterday. These fashionable ideologies that don't really have any positive, or only have secret positive content, that's not enough to provide an identity. I mean, you've got, if Yugoslavia couldn't do it, the European Union can't do it. So they're on a war path to eliminate. And this is part of the whole purpose of the EU to begin with, to eliminate national culture. Textbooks are being written that glorify Islam and attack European sovereignty. I mean, I've seen some of these. But allowing this invasion is probably the ultimate failure of the EU. But that's not the only reason why it should be abolished. There is no European identity because Europe is an extremely diverse place. And so that means their only option is to center opposing views and do everything they can to destroy national identity as the decades go on.
Well, Christian values do unite us, and we were united together as Christendom. But just as you point out there, European values, what are the values of the EU? Well, they're just promoting gay pride, I think, and multiculturalism. Well, there were competing visions to start with. Historically, the European debate about competing visions of the integration process after World War II was threefolded. The technocrats who originated the blueprint of a united Europe, and particularly the French Jean Monnet, dreamed of a federal state which practically meant the accumulation of considerable influence and power in the hands of the European central bureaucracy in Brussels, Strasbourg, and Luxembourg. The President Charles de Gaulle, 1958 to 1969, emphasized the transfer of sovereignty to an intergovernmental institution, and therefore it was placing the European-wide decisions into the hands of the Council of Heads of Executive Powers from each member state. De Gaulle tried to assert European independence vis-à-vis the USA, and this is why France vetoed twice in 63 and 67 the British application to join the EEC, considering that the UK's close ties to the United States would jeopardise the European autonomous initiatives. Indeed, the United Kingdom represented a third vision of European integration, focusing on the development of a free trade area without conceding any significant political sovereignty. When Great Britain joined the EC together with Ireland and Denmark in 73, after de Gaulle's departure, this economic vision of the European integration, in fact the EFTA, became predominant for about a decade. Nevertheless, the original winning plan of Jean Monnet was from the very beginning to create a federal European supranational state, the United States of Europe, into which will be merged the majority of the European nations, including the extremely Eurosceptic Great Britain, which finally left the European Union on January 1st, 2022. This new superstate, popularly called United Europe, will have one parliament, one court of justice, a single currency, the euro, a single government, today known as the European Council, with its Politburo, the European Commission, a single citizenship, and one flag as the external attribute of the statehood. They have this flag, they have this European Council, but they don't yet have the single citizenship. They do have the Schengen Agreement, which permits free travel throughout Europe. What do you make of what's being said here, Matt? What do you know of Jean Monnet?
Well, he's one of the more extreme theoreticians of this. We've spoken about a few others over the years. And now you look at these three visions here that you mentioned. The first two might be able to work together, but not the third one. The first one is just, you know, the accumulation of considerable influence and power in the hands of this bureaucracy. Well, that's an economic matter, because that way they could make, you know, corporate and monetary policy and not have to deal with any fallout that comes from it. That's, you know, that's the capitalist dream. The second one, the one from de Gaulle, which we mentioned already, was just an anti-American thing. And to a great extent, it was even an anti-liberal thing. And of course, you know, France always under him tried to maintain as much of an independent force as he possibly could, including their own nuclear arsenal. And the third, I think, was very naive. You don't need the EU for a free trade area, especially amongst, you know, compatible economies like Germany or the Netherlands and Britain, at least years ago. If there's going to be economic unification, there's going to be political and social unification. They go together. You can't have a European-wide economic policy on the one hand, but having national particularity on the other hand. So if there's economic unification, economic free trade, especially under the bureaucratic regime that exists now, you're going to have the political unification too. The two go together. So I think the ultimate purpose of all, Monnet makes the most sense here, not because we agree with him, but at least he's the most consistent. He laid out the blueprint, but you did have resistance. You have plenty of countries who voted against certain aspects of the EU. Now they have to be really careful. The Germans, I don't think, get anything out of the European Union. I'm shocked there really isn't more of a Germexit concept, except, of course, that it really is it's an American occupied territory. And even when you talk about, you know, citizenship, well, based on what? They have no identity. They have no focus other than corporate policy. There are no values. I mean, you know, they've denied Christianity. In fact, if anything, it's an Islamic-friendly system. And if de Gaulle was alive today, I don't know how he would be able to handle what's become of France with 10 million Muslims who want nothing to do with Europe and, in fact, despise the cultural history of the area. But Monnet was the most consistent and fanatical. And I think the initial British idea in the 70s was very naive. You don't need the EU for or the EEC for a free trade area. But you know they were simply wrong. It was far greater than a free trade area. It was meant to be far deeper than that. And of course, at least the British did was consistent. Were consistent and pulled out of it.
Well, the main problem was that the Europeans would not accept this if it was publicly declared, but the loss of national sovereignty had been the plan all along. However, those who favour it knew well that the overwhelming majority of people from Europe would never sincerely accept European unification in such a form. They would never willingly surrender their freedoms and national identities to become just a province of the European superstate. As it was, in fact, a geopolitical project originally designed against the Soviet Union and its East European satellite states during the Cold War 1.0. So what did the pro-European politicians turn to in order to realise their geopolitical plan? They simply conspired to keep the truth from the people. Now the focal question became, what is the real truth behind the European Union? The need to unite Europe grew understandably out of the devastation left behind after two catastrophic world wars. There is clear evidence, both in the successive European treaties themselves and in pronouncements by the would-be designers of Europe, that the European Union was intended from the outset as a gigantic confidence trick that would eventually hurtle the nations of Europe into economic, social, political, and religious union, whether they liked it or not. The real nature of the final goal, a federal superstate like the United States of Europe, was deliberately concealed and distorted. It was to be released in small doses to condition those who would never have accepted it until it would be too late for the whole process to be reversed or crucially changed. And of course, there has always been people that have been campaigning against this in Britain. I'm not quite sure about how Eurosceptic some of these other countries have been, like Germany or France, but there's always been a movement against this loss of sovereignty that we knew would come from joining the EU. I mean, what do you make of what's being said here, Matt?
Well, first of all, I think it's naive of him to say that this was a geopolitical project. It didn't seem to be opposed to the Soviet Union. There was free trade between heavy trade between the two entities. Communist parties allied with the USSR were huge in Italy and France for a long time. Now today, you have an anti-Russian identity, but never was there an anti-Soviet one. Number two, though, is what we've said in the very beginning, and I think is the thesis of what we're talking about here, that the entire thing is based on deceit. But it's based on deceit because, as he says, they would never accept this, you know, 40 years ago or more in its current form. And this is how liberal capitalism functions. It has to. I mean, they know they have no right to rule, that this is an oligarchy and always has been. And so they have to manipulate people into accepting their system. This was a way for a capitalist class, bankers, to have a Europe with, you know, free labor, so lowering labor costs, free immigration, lowering labor costs, and lowering transaction costs by eliminating different national currencies and regulations for the most part. That's the ultimate economic purpose. And to some extent, it succeeded, shown by the massively high levels of debt and the fact that Europe really doesn't own anything when you have almost 400% of the GDP of Belgium is debt. You know, Belgians don't own a damn thing. But him saying that he's right, this was deliberately concealed and distorted. That's what I said in the beginning. The cold and sealed community was meant to – it seemed limited. Well, it's only those two areas. So there's nothing to do with creating a super state. It's just centralizing those two things. But then, of course, later, you realize that, well, no, every industry is based on coal and steel to some extent. So the whole thing was a fraud from the beginning. And now, as we said before, with the censorship, I put in on Google, just before we came on, I Googled failures of the European Union. And the entire first page was the successes of the European Union. Now you put that same search term into any of the other, you know, Yandex or web crawler, which is the one I tend to use, it's a totally different thing. It has articles based on why the EU failed. But Google, all of those, or at least on the first couple of pages, it's the exact opposite of what I search for. So this is just par for the course. This is just a normal way that liberal capitalism operates. It is inherently a totalitarian system, and we see it today. And now with the mass immigration, they have this reserve army to attack any nationalist movement, which is part of the reason that they're here. Mostly it's for economic reasons, but the lower wages. Even the French a few years ago debated an idea of lowering the minimum wage to subsistence and below subsistence, so as to give these new migrants jobs, which was the whole point of it to begin with. Wages are going to be driven to rock bottom because of this. But that was the point of it all. This manipulation, this deceit, this censorship, it's nothing new. It seems far worse now because of the internet, which initially, gave a new platform for people like us. It turns out that it terrified them. So everything is based around this this deceit, and this gradual elimination of sovereignty was, they simply lied. Oh, these are limited measures. It won't affect you. No, we're not going to build a super state. But of course, that was the plan from the very beginning. It had nothing to do with the USSR, and it certainly didn't have anything to do with any anti-American sentiment. It was the creation. This was meant to be an example of what they want the world to be. And we could really thank God that it is a miserable failure.
Yeah, they completely rely upon the censorship. They wouldn't be able to survive if it wasn't for the censorship and the control of the narrative that they put out. And now we come to how this is being used with this Russian invasion of Ukraine and the use of the Russian threat by the EU countries. The global information and propaganda forgeries of the USA, European Union and NATO's ruling circles have become the focal source of a massive Western informational aggression against Russia during the last few decades. The Western diplomatic reaction to the absolutely legal choice of the Crimean residents to rejoin Russia in 2014, followed by the economic war initiated by the West against Russia, is absolutely illegal from the point of view of international law. The Western economic and political sanctions against Russia for re-including Crimea are just another global international crime of the Russophobic US-NATO-EU triangle states. Historically, Western politics in the international arena and international crime have long had a direct connection. All those who support and justify Western neocolonial expansion based on different color revolutions, Arab Springs, Tahrirs, Maidans, and other movements basically support the Western policy of breaking international law and rules. In other words, they simply encourage Western crimes against international law. And of course, we're told here that that Russia, by taking back Crimea, that was somehow against international law, even though there was a census that was actually taken. People elected to join Russia. They weren't forced to do that. And Crimea had always been a part of Russia before. And I think what he's referring to here is international law. Wasn't there a precedent set with Kosovo as well, that people that lived in an area could vote to be a separate area from the area that they were in? I mean, what is he referring to here about international law and Crimea, Matt? What's the specific reference? Do you know?
Well, he's, technically, even in Wilson's 14 points, self-determination is something that peoples have inherently. That's at the foundation of the UN's, right, in the initial UN charter. But the same, international law is meaningless. It's not like a law that you would have in a state or a city. These are just, vague guidelines that can be used as rhetoric when two countries want to fight each other. International law was the creation of the American elites after World War II and to some extent after World War I. It was done in their interests. And of course, they'll ignore it when it suits them. There's no sanctions on violating any kind of so-called international law, but international law doesn't bear on anybody. But the Russians, at least, were able to do it correctly and have all these areas vote, which was no shock. No one was surprised when these countries voted in huge margins to join, become independent, and then join Russia. Yeah, Kosovo is a great example, but Kosovo, the Kosovo flag is just the EU flag with the little speck of Kosovo in between. Yeah, they're not independent, even though that was the propaganda. They continue to have referendums in Montenegro to get it to separate from Serbia. They had no problem with that. I mean, it was financed by Soros and the court. They had like five elections, so they finally got the one that they wanted. It was like, you know, 50.001% voted to separate from Serbia. Now, of course, they're a NATO member. And so, you know, they accept this when it's in their interest. They reject it when it's not. And Russia, again, this didn't happen in the Soviet era. There was no sanctions on the Soviet Union. Only when Russia holds up a mirror to Europe do they get upset. Russia, it reminds Europe of its failures. The massive debt, economic failure, deindustrialization, mass immigration, no real identity, attacks on the family, attacks on the church. Russia does the exact opposite and succeeds. So that means they're forcing cognitive dissonance with European liberals. And that explains, to some extent, this violent reaction that Russia is not just engaging in policies that are anti-liberal, but are extremely successful and popular with these policies, which, of course, you can't say for someone like Liz Truss or Boris Johnson or anyone else. Western politicians are extremely unpopular. Politicians in, you know, for example, we know in Hungary and in Russia and Belarus, politicians in the ruling party are extremely popular because they do keep a lid on oligarchy as much as humanly possible. The West, of course, is based on oligarchy, and banks and corporate America dominates everything. Everything else is just window dressing. So that's, you know, some of this Russophobia is artificially invented in the U.S. To keep the U.S. you know, dollar from sagging anymore, among many other things. But Russia holds up a mirror to Europe, and they don't like what they see.
And of course, the West will say that it's a manipulation of the polls, and the approval ratings aren't true, and that's because in Russia they don't have the same access to the free media that we have over here. But at the moment, we've got Liz Truss. She just resigned with a minus 70 approval rating, and there's all this manipulation of our press in order to get us to believe things about our so-called opponents like Russia. After the Cold War 1.0, it is not only illiterate pathological Russophobes that are the victims of official Western and Eastern clients' Russophobic propaganda policy. This policy has been carried out by their democratic and liberal governments for 30 plus years, like in the Baltic states, for instance. There are much wider social and political circles that are now directly engaged in the spread of Russophobic military hysteria, with the open, merciless brainwashing of citizens on various social networks and official state-sponsored mass media, like, for example, Lithuanian Radio Television, LRT. Lies, distortion of the provisions of the sources of international law, and open manipulation of public opinion have already reached the institutional level in the majority of European countries. They simply became the official domestic and foreign policy of the pro-US NATO-EU Russophobic Central East European governments. And the author of this is a Lithuanian professor, I believe, at a Lithuanian university, or he was. I'm not sure that he's still there. So he's specifically talking about Lithuania here. Matt, what do you make of what he's saying here?
Well, the rhetoric that he's using is absolutely correct. Russophobic military hysteria. I guarantee you that if you were to ask any politician why they hate Russia so much, they're not going to give you a coherent reason. They may mention the war, but what was their excuse before that? They're ignorant. They don't need to know anything, and it's better that they don't know anything. But he's precisely correct. There's a state media. It really doesn't matter in the West whether you have state media or not, because it's the same group of people. You know, Radio Free Europe was just sold to George Soros. Nothing changed about it. We can say the same for the British Broadcasting Service, LRT, all the rest. State media exists everywhere, but it doesn't make any difference in the West because the same people who would run it on private auspices are the same people who would run it when it was controlled by the state. The ideology remains exactly the same. I wouldn't trust any poll in the West, certainly not after the last two presidential elections in the United States. I refuse to believe that the popularity the Western politicians have, as low as it is, I don't even think that's honest. We've talked about false polls and how they're used to manipulate people. But this, you know, merciless brainwashing, as he says it, there's no question about it. In Britain, I know RT and Sputnik are banned outright. So again, this doesn't come from strength. This comes from weakness. This comes, as I said, from the fact that Russia continues to hold a mirror up to Europe, and they simply don't like what they see.
Yeah, it's Europe doesn't have the pluralism as far as the media is concerned. You're right there. We can't get RT, we can't get Sputnik in Europe without a proxy, virtual proxy server. But you can get it in America still, surprisingly enough, because it seems to be America that's most against Russia, but America still allows the Russian media on the internet there. Well, you mentioned there about, or before that, about international law and it not really existing. I mean, what it is basically is a bunch of treaties between various countries. Next up, he wants to talk about international law. He says, the highest government officials treat the essential concepts of international relations in an incredibly superficial way, irresponsibly juggling terms and horribly distorting the terms presented in the sources of international law, and at the same time posing a threat to peace and security, not only in Europe, but also in the whole world. Such behaviour of the Central East European ruling elite greatly and directly harms both the personal and national interests of their citizens and the international moral prestige of their states and causes significant damage to the country's economy. The well-organised and government-controlled propaganda network in Europe spreads the following focal Russophobic fabrications: Russian aggression in Ukraine, illegal annexation of Crimea, violation of Ukraine's territorial integrity in East Ukraine, Russian interference in Ukraine's internal affairs, etc. Such framed propaganda is massively reproduced in the public space for information users, professional propagandists, journalists, and/or political commentators, who are in fact given a completely opposite version of the real truth. This propaganda changes the acting forces and thus presents the real warmongers, USA, NATO, EU, as a victim of Russian aggression and as quasi-peacemakers, with the final goal of turning their citizens in the direction of open Russophobia with the help of media manipulations. And of course, we saw this with Facebook, didn't we? That Facebook allowed people to call for the murder of Russian citizens based upon their ethnicity. It's been encouraged by all these by the mainstream media and also by the social media. What do you make of what he has to say here, Matt?
Yeah, and both parties. I think that's the case in Western Europe, too. But I think there's more to it. There's a lot of deflection and a lot of projection here, because even all of this is based on public ignorance. If the public knew the history here, they wouldn't be in favor of these policies. But we certainly know that they just don't care, especially in the U.S. That has no bearing on American policy at all. But there is a psychological focus here, and that is the idea that the U.S. especially knows that it's guilty of all of these kind of things all over the world for decades. And rather than face it and deal with it, they project it and deflect it onto this invented entity called Russia that they've created in their minds. And of course, given public ignorance, given what Johnson's law is, they can get away with it. There's not enough people who know any better. Or if there are, they get censored anyway. Giving a completely opposite version of the real truth. That's exactly it. But there's a reason for it. Not only does it suit the interests of the elite, the anti-Russian, anti-national, anti-Christian, all that, but also the fact that it absolves the U.S. of all of its endless crimes in this respect. You know, the Western economic elite have an agenda, and that agenda sometimes can be promoted by using international law. Sometimes it can be hindered by it. But that doesn't make any difference. The agenda is going to be, international law is just a rhetorical device that countries can use, empires can use to justify their policies, attack others. But when it doesn't justify it, it doesn't matter. It's just rhetoric and nothing more.
Well, next up, he talks about the suppression of alternative views and a warped version of patriotism. In newly accepted EU-NATO member states, there are a lot of insolent online trolls and all kinds of others operating in social networks who perceive such a lie from above as indisputable proof of their superiority over other, more sane members of society and use it as a basis to join illegal, supposedly patriotic groups that make provocations and unethical attacks on other members of society, members who have a different opinion, whose point of view is based on objective information and unbiased analysis of events. And I suspect he's talking there about these Baltic countries that have sizable Russian populations and like the Estonians maybe having a pop at some of the Russians, and also people that get accused of being Russian bots or Putin sympathizers just because they don't agree with the war in Ukraine. There have been physical attacks on some of these people. All the branches of government are acting against the constitutional right of their citizens to have their own opinion and express it freely. They are acting in unison against their own society and citizens. There have been cases in some countries where a district court has fined a local so-called patriot with ridiculous fines of several tens of euros for publicly calling for the killing of citizens whose opinion on the issue of Ukraine does not coincide with their own. That is enough reason in itself to investigate the myths of the information war against Russia and the open fabrications spread by the propaganda of Western governments in order to determine, based on the sources of international law, how many lies and manipulations there are in both the propaganda policy and the information space of these governments. Matt, what do you make of that, and what are your final thoughts on all of this today?
Again, all of this depends on public ignorance. This is not something that even educated Americans or Englishmen really know a lot about. There's a handful of specialists who can talk about it. And therefore, the media can paint whatever it wants. There's really not a whole lot of people over there that they're willing to pay. There's no foreign correspondents anymore. So ultimately, this just comes from the CIA and the Pentagon and these unnamed sources that have invented so many of these things. It's perfectly okay now to hate Russians. And that's typical. And Russians as people. And this has been going on for years now. And it's okay, because that kind of racism is fine if you're talking about a non-liberal people. Liberalism as an ideology is the ultimate end for these people. That's how they maintain power. And anyone who's going to attack it or show that it's false is in serious trouble. But don't forget, when they start censoring like this, eliminating entire – I mean destroying people, sending people to prison for disagreeing with the system, that's not a position of strength. That comes from a position of weakness. And that just emboldens and now radicalizes so many of us that have been kicked out of society. That's not in the regime's interest. And it's just a short-term emotional measure. It's a wounded animal lashing out. We've been talking about this for a long time, and that's what we're seeing.
Well, of course, Russians are also white, so it's perfectly okay to dehumanize other whites. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.